He's just a long-standing member. I think most people will know him. He teaches philosophy, so in a way is a professional as Trevor is. Background is in English.
He's only
you may have keyboard or something.
Is there any difference?
No, no.
How long have I got?
Oh, you have your full time.
Do I?
Yes.
Right, this talk is on the new essentialism. I imagine at the top of the sheet, the new essentialism, not just the sheet, not just essentialism. If you had to hand a sort of a label of yours to get the shape of it, what I'm planning to do, I just don't know whether it's 15 or 30 minutes, I'm going to talk a bit about the background. In some sense, Trevor's already done that, but I'll sort of put a spin on the background that suits it. Then I want to talk about some the second sections of intuition. It's sort of personal. It's my own views of philosophy of various sorts that I've accumulated over the years. So I'm sort of, I was ripe for a particular view to come along. And then I will mention this book, right, which will be the book at the point I then read this book. And I thought, oh yes, this is this is the book. And then I will outline the gist of what the book seems to say. There'll be lots of familiar things in there about sort of Kripke and water and H2O and XYZ and stuff like that that you will have met. I'll then show how this boils down to the new essentialism. And then, if time, I'll say why this absolutely hit the stiff spot for my personal beliefs and why I'm now a card-carrying essentialist and I'm not a bit. Okay, so that's the plan. So, the background, Aristotelian essentialism, Trevor said something about that. He is, of course, the quintessential essentialist. And his essentialism arose, I think, from a sort of combination of things. One is, as you know, his rejection of Plato's theory of form. Plato thinks the forms are out there. He doesn't think they're out there. He thinks they're in here. So the thing, you know, that the horse has got an essence that's in the horse, not out there somewhere. So I think that's probably the first motivation, is criticizing Plato. He began to think about what is the core of the thing. And he comes up with this notion of substance. He was faced with the problem of stability through change. If things change, like a tree changes and the leaves fall off, how can it stay being the same tree? And so this fitted nicely. This fitted nicely that we have this kind of essence that's inside the tree. So we've got essence of tree stays the same, leaves fall off, new leaves grow, but it's still a tree. So he gradually came up with that picture of what an object is and what identity is. And then a sort of picture of why nature works emerges out of that. So if you ask why the planet go across the sky, it's a big question for the Greeks, why do they move and what are they doing and so on. We have later views that, there's a view going around among the Greeks that there is a god pushing it. That comes up in Plato's The Laws, that all things are full of gods, and the gods are doing it. And we have a later view that there's a law that requires it. So the planet sits there, and the law requires it to go across the sky. But Aristotle's view is it goes across the sky because that's what planets do. It's part of the essence of a planet to travel in orbits and gravity. It's part of the essence of this book that, you know, it falls because that's what books do. And everything can be explained by the essence of the book. Now, that theory held sway for a couple of thousand years, pretty much, that was all you needed. But then, and I gather from my reading, I've got no evidence for this, but apparently the notion of a law of nature only emerged in the Middle Ages. It's a medieval concept. And I'm only guessing why, but I would guess this is something to do with God, if it's a medieval concept. And the notion that since God is a supremely powerful being, the notion that planets move themselves doesn't look right, and so the notion that there's an external hand that's moving the planet seems more satisfactory. So the laws are imposed from outside, and so there is this set of laws written in the divine law book, which requires things to move as they do. That's already the seeds of the end of Aristotelianism in the Middle Ages. Aristotle keeps going, and then it comes to a crisis in the 17th century. and essences are rejected, and we're left with laws, but still laws which are imposed from outside, imposed by God, but certainly Descartes and Newton have a notion that the laws were being imposed by the will of God, probably beyond our understanding. David Hume is a key player. We haven't mentioned David Hume very much today, but he's obviously a key player. David Hume, as you know, wasn't religious, but he inherits this view of the laws as being some I know not what that requires things to do things. We don't know what the source of it is. We probably never will. It's beyond our ability to penetrate this. And so the best you can do is observe the regularities, the patterns of what it does, reduce it to equations. Newton's the great model. Reduce it to an equation, get the pattern, and then just observing all these regularities and observing how it works is the best you're ever going to do. This, though, is a steady retreat from essentialism, which talks about what planets and so on are actually like, towards really just talking about how we can know it. And this to me is the absolutely crucial step in the whole operation. That saying what planets are actually like is ontology. And Aristotle's vision of what planets and objects are like is part of his metaphysics, and he's the king of ontology, isn't he? He's the man who tells you what the true nature of reality is, and the substances and the essences and the accidents and all that sort of thing. But in the 17th and 18th century, you get this retreat from ontology, this reluctance to make ontological claims, and we're retreating to epistemology. We're just saying, well, I've got these experiences, and all I'm prepared to say is the experiences fall down into this pattern, and I don't know what explains it, and all the rest of it. And what looks to me like a crucial moment is the move from Locke, on the one hand, to Berkeley and Hume on the other. And Locke, on the whole, is talking about a real world, and he's trying to understand how the real world works. Berkeley's probably the key player, who says, well, I'm just going to stick with the experiences. He goes all the way with idealism. And Hume's not far behind, and they're just talking about their experiences. So all you've got now, laws of nature, is a set of patterns in our experiences, and we really have no idea what's generating these patterns. Aristotle's dead. We're not going to talk about essences anymore. That's just all rubbish. The final nail in the coffin for Aristotle is Darwin, I think, because, as Trevor helpfully said, a key example for Aristotle of something having an essence is an animal. And he talks about animals quite a lot, and Trevor reeled off a list of animals, you know, that are all supposed to have essences. Of course, once you get to Darwin, it becomes pretty obvious that animals haven't got essences, because they evolve and change. The horse is the classic case, where we don't have this stable species of the horse. You have this evolving thing, and you've got these sweet little fossils of little tiny, silly, horsey-like creatures and all the rest of it. So obviously, species are changing. So the notion that there's an essence for a species absolutely looks hopeless. And so by the time you get to 1860 or something, Aristotelianism is a joke. Pretty much. Right. Underlying this picture of the world that's emerged is, this is a key idea, that the matter of the world is passive. The old word that they used to talk about was powers. Locke discusses whether things have powers or not. And increasingly we're retreating from the notion that things have powers, and we've got this totally passive matter that has no powers of any kind whatsoever. And then you've either just got apparent regularities which are baffling, or some kind of imposed regularity from outside, or something like that. It's the passive matter is the picture that we're inheriting here. I think probably most of us have been in the grips of that view. One final thing, I'm running through the background here on handout. The final thing is that built into David Hume's view of the world is the claim that if you want to know whether things are possible, you use your imagination to test it. And what we're going to say is, well, if I can imagine a sort of custard with wings flying over Oxford, sort of dropping philosophical pamphlets on it or something, then it's logically possible to happen because I can imagine it happening. And so, although we're going to say, well, it would defy the laws of nature because custard doesn't have the sufficient power weight. ratio or something. But nevertheless, there is a possible world where Custard could do this simply because I can picture it happening. And that's a crucial feature of the whole operation, that when we're trying to decide whether what is possible and what isn't, all you have to do is try out your imagination. So now we have the question, are there possible universes in which the laws of nature are completely different from the laws that we're facing? And the answer is, oh, yes, yes, yes. You know, I've got universes with custard flying around and all sorts of things, and I can imagine weird, dark, silly universes where gravity is very strong on Tuesdays and not so strong on Thursdays, and all sorts of things like that. I can imagine them, and therefore they must be possible. We're just therefore in one purely random, chancy sort of world, and so on. So this question of whether imagination reveals possibilities is at the heart of this debate. Right, that's the background. My intuition is this is a little philosophical biography, right? You won't want to hear this, but I'm a realist. I'm just a realist. I thought I might be the only realist in the room at the beginning of the day, and now I've discovered that practically everyone who stands up here is a realist. Suddenly springs in the last paragraph. if it's conclusive evidence or something like that. Paul was, I think, pretty much a realist about chemistry and so on. I've always been a realist, a pretty dive-in-the-wool realist. I've always liked Bertrand Russell's little thing in Problems of Philosophy, when the cat goes behind the furniture, you know, cat disappears, the cat walks along, disappears behind the furniture, comes out the other side, what do you think's going off behind the furniture? Well, I reckon there's a cat there. I can't prove it, you know. So I just think, you know, that on common sense grounds, I'm a sort of childish realist, if you like. But I'm very persuaded by the notion that chemistry is the thing we ought to be talking about when it comes to realism. I very much like the fact that Paul was referring to chemistry. I'm proposing a possible rule for the society that anyone who knows anything about quantum mechanics should be expelled. because it's incredibly misleading. Physicists don't understand it. People start building their ontology on quantum mechanics, and we really don't know what we're doing. Build it on chemistry. And I've got a test case. I mean, if you think about this, this is just a quick sort of defense of realism, but if you think, you know, do you think 10,000 years from now that in future they might say that this glass is not concave? Well, they might have a different word other than concave. Sorry. Yeah, you know, so I'll hollow that out. Well, of course they will. I mean, they might use slightly different vocabulary, but so every idiot knows that's concave. It's an obvious fact, right? I mean, unless you want to be very, very anti-realist indeed and read Barclay or something. So the sort of common sense, obviously, realism about proper objects, which I'm happy about. And then the main problem we've got is smaller and smaller objects. How many of you believe in the existence of bacteria? Well, this, yeah, it's all right. Anyone not believe in it? I think we all do. And of course, the point is, we worked out they were there, and we got the microscope, and you've seen the blood. Now, I've turned no hands, but do you believe that viruses exist? Well, viruses are much, much smaller, and it's taken us ages. I think you can see a virus now. I think I've seen a photograph of a virus, but they're tiny little things. And it's taken us years and years and years to get anywhere near seeing them, but we've sort of seen them. So we always thought we were there, they were there, and they are, and we've seen them. Right? Now go down below that, to the next level down, molecules and so on. DNA, I think, is a good case. I mean, does anyone seriously think that 10,000 years from now they're going to say, no, they got DNA wrong, it wasn't a double helix at all, it was a quadruple helix or something? I just don't think for a minute that's the case. We haven't quite seen it, but we've seen so much evidence. The evidence is overwhelming. So I reckon we cracked DNA, you know, well done, Crichton Watson, we cracked it. You know, and we're not going back on that. So I'm a total realist about those things, even though you can't see quite the double helix, you know, it's there. So I'm a strong realist, and all essentialists are strong realists. If you're an anti-realist, you may leave the room, because this won't concern you. It's a, you know, very much a realist philosophy. Now, when I finish in time, Secondary qualities. I bet most people in the room don't believe in the distinction between primary and secondary qualities, but I do. I just think it's absolutely spot on. It's one of the first things when I was a pupil of Trevor Hussey 30 years ago, and he explained the distinction between primary and secondary qualities to me. I thought, yes, you know, that's obviously right. Similar evidence, you know, colour blindness, you know, I mean, you think, you know, colour is a primary, secondary colour, and also you can prove it, you know, but there's an obvious distinction, you know, where you say colour blindness or something like that, he sees it one colour, I see it another. There's certain facts about the world that only appeal to one sense. You know, I mean, the shape of this tree appeals to this chair, appeals to all of my senses. The colour only appeals to one sense, and it just seems to me rather obvious that we start saying, well, my brain is contributing some of this, and the chair's contributing the rest. And I just always liked that, thought that was spot on. Well, that's something which essentialists like. You don't have to do that way. But I suggest anyone who thinks that all properties are primary, you know, that is, that colours are coloured, grass has actually got greenness in it, that seems to me an incoherent view. The view that all qualities are secondary, well, you're friends with Berkeley and Hume if you think that, but that seems to me that's a slippery slope to, well, you don't get that, you know, all qualities are secondary, that's everything's completely mind dependent. You can, you know. So anyway, I endorse that one. On causation, just the common sense that one intuition that everyone has against David Hume, that even though you say, well, there's all these regularities and constant conjunction, and this thing happens, then that thing happens, there's this sort of thing that some things happen to happen, and some things have just got to. You know, you have this strong intuition. Now, that's not an argument, but it's just sort of, I've always felt, well, there's something he's explaining here, you know, that, you know, if I sort of make a noise, you know, that, I mean, do you think I could hit this chair and not make a noise? You know, this can't be done. Well, why not? I don't know. Let's see. Zombies. Those of you, I haven't time to explain a zombie if you've never met zombies. But if you've met zombies in the philosophy of mind, basically these are creatures that are exactly physically like us, but not conscious. Now, this is supposed to be a test, sort of, first of whether the mind is dependent on the physical world. And I immediately, when I met zombies, I thought, this is rubbish. Zombie, you know. If I make an exact replica of Marianne down to the last molecule, I'm confident it will think like Marianne. It will have Marianne's consciousness. I don't know whether Marianne's conscious, confident of that, but I am. I just can't make sense of the notion that you could have something that's physically identical and doesn't have the consciousness. So we'll come back to that. You know, this may all seem irrelevant, but I'm hoping it will become relevant. Gru. Again, I haven't got time to explain that, but if you've ever met Gru, this is a famous problem of induction where there's something supposed to be green up until a certain time and then blue. And then the question is, if you observe it, what observations will confirm that? So I look at some green thing, you know. Now, is that green or is that Gru? Well, it's green. It looks green now, but it could also be Gru, because it might turn blue tomorrow evening, and I'd be confirming the same thing. Now that again, lots of people have the intuition that this is somehow incoherent, that just sort of this random property that things should go from green to blue. Now, I'm sure sometimes that I've not got to the point of this, but I think I have. We'll see. But the question here, I'm not jumping ahead too far, but the question is, are we talking about properties or are we talking about predicates? Right? Predicates are in language, properties are in the world. So, and I think that's going to be a very important distinction. Cancer and smoking. I just offer this to you. We're talking about science. This is one of my models for what science is and how we should understand science. Smoking causes cancer. Right? We all know that. Why do we know that? Statistics. Right? The statistical connection between smoking and cancer became overwhelming in about 1953 or something, wasn't it? And then 15 years later the tobacco industry told us that this was the case. But it was a statistical regularity. This is David Hume's regularities. We spotted the regularity. We thought we've definitely got a law here. But why does smoking cause cancer? We don't know yet. Right? And so there's a two-tier operation. Getting the regularity so strong that we're totally confident about it, and it's overwhelmingly likely that it's right, And then there's getting the mechanism, you know. And if we actually get the mechanism, that's the end of the discussion. We haven't got the mechanism. Right? Think about the theory of evolution. The superficial picture is overwhelmingly, in my view, in favour of evolution. Actually getting the mechanisms for all these little variations is very hard, because of course the evidence is what we've got. So there seems to me science has got this two-stage quality of spotting the patterns, spotting the regularities, making the predictions and all that. But that's at the beginning. Okay? You've got to dig deeper in order to find out what's actually causing it and why it's happening. One far on the moon, one of my favourite examples. Can you imagine a bonfire on the moon? Right? Well, I put it to you, if you can imagine a bonfire on the moon, you're not very good at chemistry. Right? Or physics. Right? Because you've forgotten what a bonfire is. Yeah. Bonfires need oxygen. Right? So if I say, can you imagine a bonfire in a place where there's no oxygen? You might say, well, yeah, I can do that. Yeah. Can you imagine oxygen combining with wood at a high temperature where there's no oxygen present? I'm struggling now, right? Well, that's what I asked you. Can you imagine a bonfire on the moon? So this is the imagination point, that you're lured by your imagination to think you can have a bonfire on the moon. And then when you understand it and you get down to the mechanisms, you suddenly realize you can't. Right? Which means the possibilities suddenly start collapsing. There just aren't nearly so many possibilities as you thought. I always like that example. Miracles. David Hume has a famous argument against miracles. Personally, when I was quite young, I was in doubt about miracles, because I used to wonder, when you turn water into wine, exactly what happens in the water? You know, you've got this jar full of H2O molecules, and then suddenly you've got all these other molecules that appear from somewhere, you know, these sorts of, you know, I won't go there, right? But I mean, thinking about the actual mechanics of a miracle is the point at which I find it very difficult to cope. When you stand back and say, could this happen, you say yes. And you think back at exactly what's happening, it's not so easy to believe. Functionalism, it's just a little point about functionalism of mind, which is that I've always thought functions never quite answer the problem. You say, well, there's all these functions interlocking, and there's this kind of flow diagram of your brain, and that's what your mind is. But there always seems to be a prior question, which is, if a part of your mind is operating in this way as a sort of causal link to another part of your mind, what is it about that bit of your brain that enables it to do it? If you give a complete functional account of the mind, you haven't finished, because you've got to say, why is it able to have this function? My example would be a corkscrew. You know, you could give a functional account of a corkscrew. It's meant for getting wine corks out of a bottle, you know. You say, what is it? Well, it gets corks out of a bottle. Fine, thank you very much. You're not very curious if you don't ask, how does it do it? And then you have to say, well, it's a sort of curly thing. You see, you screw it in and you get the tension, you know, and all the rest of it. So the function is one thing. How it can perform this function is next. So everything I'm saying is dig deeper, right? And science, this is the message that's coming. And science is about digging deeper. But I put it to you that most of the science we've been talking about this morning is superficial science.
Yeah.
Right? And then we want deeper science. What else we got? Natural sets. The question of when you divide things up into sets. I'm no expert on set theory, but there seems to be an idea around that sets are completely conventional. And if we think about dividing the people up in this room, I can divide them all up into people who watched Coronation Street sometime in the last year or something. You know, hands up those who watched Coronation Street in the last year. And those who haven't, you know. So we got two sets of people, and there are all sorts of thousands, billions of ways we can slice people up. But men and women, you know, that's it. You can't choose about that. And it's not sort of, well, I've got this arbitrary idea, you know, that we divide the people up in the room to men and women. It's just a natural feature of the world that the people divide into men and women. So I put it to you that there are natural sets and conventional sets. You've got to keep those very distinct. Natural sets is the idea, to Plato's phrase, cutting nature at the joints. You know, there's a way the world chops up, and you can choose some of it, but some of it, down at the level where you actually contact, you can't choose how you chop this thing up. It falls into a certain way. Induction.
Induction.
This is just the sort of intuition that there's to be completely sceptical about induction doesn't seem quite right. You know, you say all swans are white. Well, okay, swans is a tricky one, and of course, famously, there are swans around. But there are some other things where you do a bit of induction and you observe a whole lot of things like electrons or something, and you say, well, they've got the negative charge off. After a while, you stop looking because you think, well, that's pretty obvious. Then you've got that one. And it's just sort of overwhelming. Well, we want to know why it's overwhelming. We're not just going to be satisfied with Hume's total skepticism about this. That's completely irrational. It isn't completely irrational. Rational people are good at induction.
Yes.
And finally, human nature. I'll sort of fuss over that, but I believe in human nature. I'm a fan of virtue theory and morality, and that needs human nature to operate. I think there's a certain human nature, and sometimes you have good natures, and other people don't have bad natures, and that's a fact, you know, and that's part of the discussion. And you need a notion of human nature, so I always like that. Okay, that's my sort of philosophical overview of certain issues. Next, the groundwork. The groundwork is famous stuff in philosophy, if you've been sort of following modern philosophy. Saul Kripke has a famous point about identity, whether something has an identity or not. And the traditional notion of identity is, well, it's based on what's sometimes referred to as the nominal essence of something. The nominal essence is the essence of the descriptions it has to fit. So we say something like, well, what's a horse? Well, it's got a sort of, you've got to be able to say it's got a mane and hooves and stuff like that. And there's this set of sentences that it's got to fit, and then that makes it a horse. Kripke sort of put a bomb under all that with this notion. I think the key word to understand Kripke, as I understand it, is baptism. That there's some kind of standard horse thing, you know, back in 5000 BC, and people said, well, that's a horse. And from then on, that thing's being baptized as a horse, and it's going to stay a horse all through, well, forever. And it's in relation to this baptized object. It's not because it fits a certain set of descriptions. It's not what it looks like or anything like that. It's because it's got this essential thing. The question of who is, could Aristotle, is there a possible world where Aristotle wasn't a philosopher? You know, well, there might be, but is there a possible world where Aristotle isn't Aristotle? Well, what that means, you know. I mean, he's got to be this bloke, you know, probably defined by his DNA or something like that. You know, this bloke was a slave in another world, all right, but he's got to be Aristotle. And so this identity stays the same over all possible worlds. Well, if Aristotle is a philosopher in one world and a slave in the other, how are you going to pin down the fact that he's still Aristotle even though he's changed? Because of the essence. Right? He's got essence of Aristotle. This slave, you know, working in the palace in wherever it is, you know, who might, you know, clever slave, you know, but he's got the essence of Aristotle. That's why you can say he's still Aristotle, even though he's not a philosopher, or he wasn't taught by Plato or something like that. So the notion of essences is coming out of the fact that identities stay the same across all possible worlds and so on. So this is the first germ of this thing. One of the famous things that Kripke discovers is a posteriori necessities. Traditionally, sort of, all necessities are a priori. Just by thinking about it, you can work out sort of necessities about the world. And then all the contingent stuff you can do by doing a bit of science and going and having a look. Well, so the famous one, Hesperus is Phosphorus, if you've met that. The morning star is the same as the evening star. You know that one. The Greeks discovered it was actually the same thing. It's Venus. One people call it a morning star, other people call it the evening star. Eventually they figure out it's the same thing, right? So it's got an identity, right? You're then left with, in all possible worlds, that thing is that thing, the planet Venus, right? It can't be there's another world where it's the morning one, it's both the morning star and the evening star are separate. Given that it's identical, it's damn well identical. So it's going to stay identical across all possible worlds. It's a necessary truth. That's a necessary truth that's been discovered by scientists. Right? Now, I hope you're getting interested. Right? Necessary truths discovered by scientists. But I thought scientists only discovered contingent truths, you know, and they're all provisional and all the rest of it. But we've identified this thing. It's true in all possible worlds. And it takes a telescope and a bit of brain power to work it out. So, this is, I hope, getting more interesting. There's a lovely little idea of Kripke's. Consider the possibility that God creates all the objects on Wednesday and then adds their properties on Thursday. How's that sound? Well, I think the example would be the example of a magnet. Do you think we can have a magnet which is a nice bar of iron with all the whatever it is coned in the right direction the way magnets are, but it isn't magnetic? That it wouldn't, it's got all the features of a magnet, but it won't attract any another piece of iron. That seems to be a sort of incoherent idea. If it's got all those properties, it's going to have to do all those properties require it to do. God can't make the objects on Wednesday and then add the properties on Thursday, because when you make the objects, you've made the properties. That's what making an object is. It's sticking all the properties in. So the properties necessarily go with the object. The properties aren't optional. The properties aren't optional. The laws aren't going to be optional either. Right? See where we go. Water, I've spent ages on Twin Earth, but you get the idea. You probably all, most of you know this one, that we've got wet stuff that falls out of clouds on this planet, we've got wet stuff that falls out of clouds on that planet. I call it water on that planet, they call it water, and everything seems identical. Scientists dig in, find this is H2O. It isn't H2O, it's some other stuff deep down at the Earth, in the inner level. Putnam says, therefore, the concept of water is not about the superficial descriptions. The concept is about what it actually is. Right? And what I meant by water on this planet was this stuff here, not their stuff. Their stuff, something else. Right? So in other words, this is the essence. We've dug into the essence. The essence of this stuff in rivers is H2O. That's what I meant by water. The essence of their stuff is something else. So they actually meant something else by water, because they didn't mean the superficial properties, they meant the essence. So you can see that idea is beginning. So what we've got is a bunch of ideas coming together, and we're suddenly thinking essences are rather more important. They will be marginalised as Aristotelian stuff, and actually it's absolutely central to our understanding of the world. Yes, with this we're going to track out the notion that you can decide what's possible just by using your imagination. Okay. We're going to decide what's possible by investigating. Right? Scientists, get out there and find out what's possible, please. Don't leave it to the philosophers. The philosophers are useless. the last piece in the jigsaw, Sidney Shoemaker, had an interesting discussion about properties. In which, well, I'll just read out what it says here. Causation is not relations between events. People trying to say, well, what relates to what when this thing called, when I do this? Is that one event relating to another event? Right? Well, what happened then? Right? What we've got to talk about is not that there's just one event correlated with another event. We've got to talk about powers. My hand is a very powerful instrument which strikes this. This has a particular power of being rather resonant plastic, and so the combination of this power meeting that power causes this. It's not just, there's not this superficial pattern that we're observing of events. What we're saying is, it's because of the nature of my hand and this thing that these give rise to this. So now powers have come back into the game. So hence the proposal is that we redefine a property of disposition. Now at this point there's metaphysical controversy. What is there in this room? Well, there's a load of physical objects. What we're now proposing is, in addition to physical objects, there are also dispositions. I'd like to say there are many possibilities in this room. And we're going to have to include this in our ontology of what we think actually exists in this room. If I'm thinking of dropping this, well, there is a possibility of a noise. When it drops, there's a distinct possibility that there could be a noise. It's built in for the floor, this, the nature of gravity and so on. I'm not going to do it, right? But it was here. There was a real possibility, and that was one of the things that was present in the room. And you might not like that, because if you're one of these people who want to get your ontology down to the meanest possible, to have a room full of possibilities. There are an awful lot of possibilities in this room. So I just built up, and I'm trying to get the ontology right, but I just had an awful lot to the ontology. So that's just a warning about the problem. Right, so now we come to the theory. What is the theory?
I should go on. You're running tight on time, but I should go on.
I'll accelerate then. Okay. I think we're at the point where you're getting the hang of it. You can see what's emerging. and the whole point of the handout is if I don't finish, you can read the handout. So we're now proposing their essences. Okay, we've got a new view of nature. And it's a hierarchy of essences. Let me just explain, well, what we're going to say about horses. Aristotle said horses have an essence. Darwin says they don't. Darwin's right. But horses have a certain nature, they have a certain capacity, they have a certain potential. You can ride horses, they jump over fences up to a certain point, you know, they do things, they've got all sorts of possibilities. So what we're going to say is that a horse is composed, you've got to think of the levels of a horse. So the level, we get out of the quarks and the electrons and so on, make a horse. All quarks are the same, all electrons are the same, they have no individuality, they have a fixed. They're a natural kind, absolutely rigid, stay essential, all parts of the universe as far as we can see. Never know, science is going to check that for us. And in the horse, they stay absolutely the same. Molecules, pretty stable, pretty fixed. We get a few isotopes creeping in, sort of complexities, so it gets a bit more complicated, but pretty stable. You know, the enzymes in horse stomachs or something, they're all pretty much the same, aren't they? And so on. Then you get more complicated, and horse brains got incredibly complicated. So you can't talk about the essence of a horse brain, because they're all slightly different. But so you've got this hierarchy of essences from very fixed essences at the bottom, gradually to sort of slightly broader essences, and there's a sort of loose essence for a horse, of what a horse is like, just as there is for a human being, right? We can tick that one off. Human beings have a certain essence, but it's not absolutely fixed, so there's room for individuality. And then there are some things that are utterly individual. So this is the key proposal. There's this hierarchy of interlocking essences which is going to be investigated by scientists. Here's the controversial bit, number 26. The proposal is that the laws of nature are necessary. Most people, I guess a lot of people in the room were with me up to this point and suddenly thought, what? The laws of nature are necessary. How could this be? Well, can you have a magnet that isn't magnetic? You can't, you know. Can you have a planet that doesn't, a planet that has no gravity? Could there be a planet with no gravity? Because it's part of the essence of a planet that it generates gravity. Incidentally, footnote, action at a distance. We're going to solve that by saying it's part of the essence of the Earth that it has gravity. The big mistake of Newton and co. is to think that the Earth stops at its surface. Right? The Earth is an enormous object spreading out into its gravitational field. So there is an action at a distance. The moon and the Earth are part of the same object. They've run into one another in gravitational field. There isn't any action at a distance. Now we understand the essence of the Earth better. We don't have this problem anymore. Right? This is how essentialism can solve your problem. The laws are necessary. I've got to do this one. How can this be? Well, the proposal is that the stuff must have these properties, and there's no way to do it. And you're thinking, well, surely there could be a universe that's different from this one. And the answer is yes, but it would have to have different stuff in it. Right? If it's got different stuff in it, it'll be different. So if there's far more stuff in it, gravity will be much stronger, and so on. And if there's completely different, there's element with atomic number 179 in it or something, then no doubt there'll be essences we've never dreamt of. But if it's got the 92 elements we've got naturally occurring and the same amount of stuff, you're going to have the same laws. So this is like zombies, you make a universe that's identical to this one, it's going to have the same laws. You can't have different laws because when you made the stuff, you made the laws. So what are the laws? The laws are regularities. Hume's right. They're the regularities generated by essences. What we're trying to do is dig below the mere Humean pattern to get the explanation of the pattern. Inference to the best explanation is something I'm very keen on. This is the notion of how you can get beyond mere observation of evidence. You go to the explanation. You can't see it, but you can explain it. DNA is our best explanation. No one's ever seen DNA, but it's overwhelmingly a fantastic explanation for what we've seen. So the explanations of the behavior of the essences will be your laws, and the laws will be necessary. If you make the same universe, you're going to have the same laws. If you want different laws, make a different universe. Well, let me say anything else. Just give me a second. Is there anything else we must say? we can't eliminate necessities and possibilities from our world. I'm telling you, possibility, this is in sort of the metaphysical sense. So David Lewis wants to eliminate necessities and possibilities. Well, he can't. Because there are necessities and possibilities in this room, and there are facts about the room. There are facts of science, necessities and possibilities. Keep your semantics and your epistemology and your ontology separate. This is one of the crucial golden rules for essentialists. People who get muddled up about science, they're confusing these three levels, and in particular being taken in by the thinking all there is to life is epistemology. There isn't. There's a world out there. That's the ontology. That's the thing they're trying to get at. I can skip over intuitions explained because they're sort of self-evident. One or two problems. I think I've mentioned all the problems and problems.
The book. You want to read the book?
Mark Anson said. It's The Philosophy of Nature by Brian Ellis. I highly, highly, highly recommend it. This is the new Bible. You've all got to read it. It's the secret of the universe here, right? He's an Australian philosopher. He's not a sort of top philosopher, but he's supposed to pull it together. It's available in Acumen books, and this is the book which I just thought, yes, this is the book for me. The Philosophy of Nature, subtitle, A Guide to the New Essentialism, by Brian Ellis.
I'm just a bit conscious of the essentialism of the tea break, which is programmed for 3:30, and I, contradicting what I was saying earlier, I think if we break now and try and go into separate rooms, we'll lose 10 minutes or so there, and I think 20 minutes won't be long enough to have any sensible discussion. Actually, so being a realist about this, I think maybe we should revert to the old-fashioned process. Can I therefore suggest that we just allow a few sort of questions to Peter, just for clarification, and then the other three speakers come up onto the stage, and we'll just start a group discussion in the way that we conventionally do it, and break the seal. I hope you don't mind that change, and I think it's a realistic way. So, can I leave you answering some questions while I go and get some chairs?
Okay.
You didn't mention at any point the distinction between logical and natural necessity. I wonder if that comes into your thinking at all.
Yes, it does. The question is, I haven't mentioned the distinction between logical and natural necessity. Yes, I've got something rather... we might add metaphysical necessity. Not many people do. You're obviously on my side. Most people make the distinction, I think, between logical necessity, which is kind of tautologies and sort of definitions generating necessary truths in all possible worlds. Then you've got metaphysical necessities, which are true across all possible worlds. And then you've got natural necessities, which I take to be necessities in this world with these laws of nature. But the question that's obviously at stake is whether the laws of nature are necessary. Obviously, I'm arguing that the laws of nature are metaphysically necessary, so that the category of natural necessity drops out. There's logical necessity, which is just a bunch of tautologies, and then there's metaphysical necessity, which is true across all possible worlds. But the news here is that the metaphysical necessity includes physical things as well as just ideas. So that's my picture.
I'll think about that just for a second. There's something that's bothering me about that.
Right, Frank's got a question.
Can you clarify what you were saying about the Zenfars? Because you seem to be making, when you're talking about Aristotle tests something equivalent to exemplary examples. I polygraph, I'm afraid.
Well, the idea of exemplars is sort of standard to Kripke and Putnam, as I understand it. that you had this notion of baptism, seems to me the helpful one, you know. The little thing is born and you give it a name, so we christen this water, you know, and this is the stuff we happen to have here. There's just a theoretical idea that there's some little puddle somewhere back in the mists of time that got christened water by the first person to come up with this word, and everyone said, yeah, that's a useful word for that stuff. And from then on, there's a kind of continuum. It used to be called the causal theory of reference, that our reference to the theory to the word water can be tracked back through history to this moment when someone said, that's water. And so that's the exemplar, and we're assuming it was H2O that he was pointing at.
Yeah, I think it's just tricky having a single exemplar, so then you're back into all the problems of universals. You can just say, well, I'm
there is a, yeah, there is a problem. Obviously, if you baptize the horse and you say, well, right, that's a horse, and you point at a three-legged horse that happens to have had a bad day, you know, and then you would be misrepresenting what a horse was, and I take big fine and something else, and that would be. You'd have to then say, well, I think that was a bad example. The next day we say, well, that was a bad example, we'll choose this one instead. But that raises the question, well, why are you switching, you know? But obviously we say most horses have got four legs, I suppose, but I don't know. Yeah, it's a good point.
I think most horses
are going to
baptize.
What?
Sorry.